Today, it's my pleasure to be joined by Andrew and Mark from Rough Grouse Society Canada. Talk to me a little bit about what that landscape is. How much public land is there and what opportunities exist, Andrew?
In Nova Scotia, we're pretty open access, actually. So if it's forested land and you've got 400 yards from a building, you can walk onto it, basically. I would say we are a hidden gem of rough grouse in the east here.
What does it look like from a bird numbers perspective, just grouse in general? What are we looking at?
I think we've got some pretty good grouse numbers this year. It's very easy to get 50 to 75 woodcock flushes in a day, and you can easily see between 15 to 30 grouse flushes in a day.
What do you know about if somebody from the U.S. wants to come hunting there? Any other hoops to jump through, things that you're aware of on how a person from the U.S. would line up a hunt in Canada?
The challenge there is...
Hey everyone, Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast, the show that brings you conversations, stories, and traditions from all across the uplands. The Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt and supported by folks just like you via our Patreon community. If you want to stay up to date and not miss any of our upcoming episodes, be sure to subscribe and follow the show in your podcast player or on YouTube, wherever you're listening or watching today. Tap that button for me. Thank you for doing so. And with that said, let's get into today's conversation on the Birdshot Podcast. On the Birdshot Podcast today, it's my pleasure to be joined by Andrew and Mark from Rough Grouse Society Canada, a couple of gentlemen north of the border, as they say. Thanks for joining me today, guys.
Thanks for having us.
It's my pleasure.
All right, let's clear the air right away. So now I know this already. I'll have you guys put us on the map where you are, but I must be talking to Canadians fans. We're not talking to Leafs or Jets fans, are we?
I'm an upper Canadian, so I'd be a Leaf fan. I'm an East Coast transplant from northeastern Ontario.
You got me in Boston. So, because we're where I'm sitting, we're closer to the Bruins than we are the Canadians. So, yeah, I'm a big Bruins guy.
I love it. That's cool. I'm not paying a ton of, I'm obviously following the wild here, but we're off to a rocky start. How about you guys?
Yeah, it doesn't look so good, but we're a little Jays focused right now. So we'll get through baseball season before we start talking hockey.
Fair enough. Yeah, it's early yet. And yeah, that's nearing the peak. So yeah, all good. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to join us today, guys. And again, we're talking Rough Grouse Society Canada and kind of Canada bird hunting in general. Man, it's been a while since I think I've had someone on the show from Canada. Let's start, kind of rewind a little bit. And I'll start with you, Andrew. Just how'd you get into bird hunting and family history and bird dog? Tell me a little bit about yourself and as it relates to upland hunting.
Yeah, I mean, didn't grow up in a hunting family. A lot of fishermen in there, spent a lot of time fishing. And, you know, I had buddies that were into hunting and, you know, used to tag along while I was, you know, late high school, early college years. And in college, just decided to take up waterfowling. Ended up at a college and then university with some great bird hunting around. Got into waterfowling, which then led me to dogs. I've got I run two black labs. We're into the hunt tests, the field trials, and hunt them exclusively. And you know, it started off as labs, moved to the East Coast. Waterfowling is good, but it's not like what I experienced in Eastern Ontario. And bought a little woodlot, and you know, grouse were everywhere. We've got a couple hundred acres here, and man, it's you know, lots of grouse. And figured natural progression was to start into the grouse about 10 years ago. And man, I was hooked. I you know, the rush, just being outside, walking in the woods, fall, you know, the best time of year out here. And recently picked up an English setter. I was down in Maine, Sugarfoot Kennels, David Mosier. And I've got a little English setter pup here that I'm training now. You know, been running our labs for grouse, so we're a little bit unconventional for grouse dogs. But, you know, we experienced success with that. And, you know, that just, you know, got us into it a little bit deeper. And I have this ability to take on way too much when it comes to volunteering and being a part of different groups. So, you know, I've been with Delta Waterfowl and Ducks Unlimited for almost 2 decades. Joined Rough Grouse Society, started a Nova Scotia chapter about 3 or 4 years ago. You know, was invited to join the national board, and, you know, just never look back. Just absolutely love it. Do a little outdoor writing on the side, a little photography. So, you know, it was just one more thing to occupy what little time I've got. 3 kids, and all of them are into the outdoors. They want to follow around. You know, I've got my 13-year-old daughter's big into dog training. She trains her dog as well, and she's got a 3-year-old female lab, and she runs the tests and trials with me. She's been training since she was 11 and competing since she was 12, standing up there with all the grown folk up at the line. And you know, it's my 9-year-old just can't get enough of following me through the grouse woods. And my middle child loves to cook wild game. So it's kind of, you know, it comes around full circle here. So
I love it, man.
Trying to leave it better than the way that we got it here. So trying to make sure that healthy forests are a normal thing out here and across Canada. And just want to see birds in the woods, see healthy forests, and give them something to experience forever here. So
appreciate the background. And obviously the kids stuff, that's, I got my 2 young boys and we're getting into all that stuff. I'm a little bit behind you, but I love hearing that. It's, my kids are having a lot of fun with it. Is your professional world, is that totally unrelated to grouse or anything?
Yeah. So I'm a biologist by training, and I work full-time here in Nova Scotia with government doing, I'm the fisheries manager, freshwater fisheries manager for the province. So I spend most of my time playing with fish so that I have enough time to chase birds in the fall. So my summer season's on fish, but it frees up a lot of the fall for chasing birds and Atlantic salmon out here. So
that's super cool. I just finished up another recording this morning with a fish biologist who,
okay,
same deal. You know, everybody's got to pay the bills and make sure you have enough free time to chase birds in the fall.
That's it.
Yeah.
So.
Mark, how about you, buddy?
Well, I grew up in a hunting family, never around dogs and primarily chasing deer. And our big thing as a family, we're going after moose kind of every year as well. And so, and I still guide every year for moose here in the East Coast. And I'm an accidental upland hunter that kind of turned it into a passion. About 15 years ago, I got my first dog and she was a showbred Springer. And both of her parents hunted a lot. The breeder hunted, even though he was running show lines. And I had no intention to hunt upland with her. My plan with Willow was to do some search and rescue. And I think at 14 or 16 weeks of age, we went for a walk up at our family farm. I said, well, I'll bring the old single shot 12 gauge. And I watched her work her first 2 grouse at 16 weeks in kind of mid-October. And something just switched. And so I was like, okay, this is what we're doing. And I went from never having anything besides a single shot 20 or single shot 12 gauge to absolutely obsessed with the uplands. And so chased her for 11 years through the woods. And she was, for a field bred dog and my first dog, she may turn out to be my dog of a lifetime. She was just phenomenal. And then, you know, as I progressed through the obsession, as we all do, I made the decision to move to more to a versatile breed. And 2.5 years ago, picked up a poodle pointer outside of Syracuse, New York, from Lunatic Fringe's poodle pointers, and haven't looked back since. So I've got a 2.5-year-old absolute missile in the woods named Gus, and he's a great little dog, and so that's really where the upland piece started for me. Always been very, very interested in forest management. My background's in forestry and environmental management. I'm a forester as well as a professional guide here in New Brunswick. But so that whole mixed age class, how do we manage the forests? I worked professionally both in Canada and the U.S. in the forest industry before leaving the forest industry about 10 years ago. But still get to play with it, Nick, a little bit. We've got a good chunk of property here in Atlantic Canada as a family. And so I manage that very, very intentionally. We've got about 1,000 acres under management right now. And quite frankly, predominantly I manage it for upland birds. So we make sure we have a nice mixed age class. We've got about, I would say about 450 acres of really nice prime bird cover that we manage pretty tightly here as a family. And then professionally, I get to spend a lot of time strategically with a lot of the major forest industry players around Canada. And so always staying tight to kind of how we manage the forest on that side.
Yeah. Oh, great stuff, man. You guys are giving me we could go a lot of different directions. I do want to just kind of continue to set the stage a little. You guys are in Eastern Canada. It's, you know, New Brunswick it comes up often enough. I think probably here in the U.S. because it's close and it's kind of like, you know, it's sort of built up as this, you know, the grouse and woodcock hunting paradise and salmon fishing too, which Andrew, you could have, of course, speak to. I guess talk to me a little bit about sort of what that is, what that landscape is, the opportunity, how much public land is there and what opportunities exist, Andrew?
Yeah. So in Nova Scotia, we're pretty open access, actually. If it's wooded land, you know, it's basically firearm discharge from houses or businesses. So if it's forested land and you've got 400 yards from a building, you can walk onto it. Basically, it's pretty open access. You know, like your state forest or your public lands, we have what we refer to as crown lands. And you know, I'm sitting about 15 minutes from 250,000 acres of crown. There's all kinds. I mean, Nova Scotia is a community built around the coast and, you know, primarily, you know, fishing towns. And you know, we have a few not major urban centers, Halifax being our biggest with, you know, 700,000 or 800,000. Most of the urbanization happens around the outside of the province, the coastal areas within a few kilometers of the coast. And interior, we have vast expanse of forest. And you know, forest management has not always been our strong suit, but what we do have is you know, pretty intensive forestry that happens. And as a result of that, you know, you end up with regeneration and cycles and, you know, multi-age stands and pretty incredible grouse habitat. You know, it's, I would say, you know, we are a hidden gem of rough grouse in the east here. You know, New Brunswick gets a lot more attention than Nova Scotia, I would say, probably because of its proximity to Maine, being able to just easily cross the border, and not many want to continue the drive down and across the isthmus into Nova Scotia. But we've got some incredible grouse. Southern part of the province has some pretty strong woodcock flight too. You know, we see decent woodcock here, but not like what they see in the south. And New Brunswick's certainly better than that. Mark will talk about that, I'm sure. But, you know, our access is really phenomenal. And the other thing the province has done a lot of is as those old family farms and century farms kind of get abandoned and left, the Crown's been buying them up. The province buys them up and they become part of public land. So a lot of what I'm hunting, we'll talk about that probably a little bit later, is old overgrown pastures with wild apples all over them, berries, fruit trees. They've been spread by cattle, and those birds, you know, I'm not hunting at this time of year. I'm not into those aspen stands, your traditional sort of New England grouse covers, but rather we're hunting old farmsteads and sort of work in lowland areas with alders and sort of the upland areas with fruit. And that's where our birds seem to concentrate in the fall once those apples drop. So it's unique and pretty exciting because the birds tend to group up. They'll form bigger coveys. I mean, I was out on the weekend and, you know, pushed coveys of 5 or 6 grouse at a time, and it was pretty awesome. So yeah, that's Nova Scotia in a nutshell.
That's the, you guys are, I'm sure, you know, that's the stuff you read about, you know, the old abandoned farms. And do you have the stone walls too?
Yeah, there's lots of old stone fences out there. And, you know, it good cover. We do have populations of wild ringneck pheasants here as well. So,
oh, really?
It's, you know, it's pretty good that way too, that, you know, you could see any of the three. I mean, we had, I've been one bird short of a slam several times where we've seen snipe, woodcock, grouse, and ringnecks all in the same covey. So, or same covers. So, it's pretty neat almost hitting the slam in a single shoot. So
that's so interesting to me, because here, like, you know, east of the Mississippi, wild pheasants are, you know, I know they exist in certain areas, but is there a supplemental program alongside, or it's just completely wild pheasant?
Just completely wild. There are you know, there's probably half a dozen pheasant preserves in the province.
Yeah, sure.
And some of those are in areas with good wild populations, and so I'm sure some of those birds escape, but
right.
Really, the science suggests that those pen-raised birds don't often survive long periods of time after they've been released. You know, there may be the odd one that finds its way in, but no, it's just, I think it's climate-related, food-related. There's good cover. And I'll say that under-pressured, I don't want to say severely under-pressured, but, the areas that I hunt, I'm yet to ever see another hunter. And, you know, that's pretty par for the course. When it comes to grouse harvest, I mean, our group accounts for about one third of the grouse harvest in my immediate area in our county. So it's, you know, we really don't see much. And I would say the majority of grouse harvested in Nova Scotia are shot by deer hunters on their way into deer camp or looking, you know, bird walks in
casual
while they're sitting
partridge
there.
Hunting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, running roads and, you know, a lot of ATV travel on the logging roads looking for deer. And they happen to see a grouse and pop one off the shoulder of the road. But, you know, you get 40 yards into the woods and I've never seen another hunter walk in the woods in 10 years. So I'm yet to run into another upland hunter.
Wow. That's wild. Yeah. I did want to ask you kind of about the bird hunting culture and that kind of stuff. From a climate perspective, I would imagine it's maybe a little bit, you know, somebody from the U.S., you think Canada, you might think, you know, bitterly cold. You know, I'm here in northern Minnesota. We get winters, but you guys probably are a little bit more moderate just with all the water around you.
Yeah, ocean regulates a lot of that. Precipitation really comes and goes. This has been one of the driest years on record for us. I think, you know, going back to the 20s, we haven't seen such little precipitation as we did this year. But, you know, in comparison, 2 years ago, we ended up with a single snowfall over 5 feet in my area.
Holy smokes.
Three days, we ended up with 5 feet. You know, we do hit some hurricanes. So that even that contributes, you know, as much destruction and damage as it does to the woods. It's a natural cycle and it encourages that regenerated growth. And provides so much cover for ground foraging birds that, you know, our primary predators out here would be avian predators. You know, we have a strong goshawk population, lots of owls, lots of red tails. So, I mean, that provides great cover for them with all the blowdown. There's, you know, a lot of it's still rooted. So they're budding and able to eat all winter long. They, you know, the snow tunnels, grouse do well with good snow cover, long as it's not too hard packed. So, but it's funny, we get a melt shortly after that. So, you know, we really come and go in cycles where we'll get all that snow. So 5 feet of snow and a week later, we're down to a foot of snow or less, and then it's gone. And then all of a sudden another dumping and it comes and goes pretty quick. So it's different. It's a less consistent winter than what you would see, you know,
that's kind of what I was envisioning. Yeah.
Yeah. That's, and I think that's just a function of being being right on the coast, right? Being right on the Atlantic coast, and the wind directions make a lot of difference. So.
Yeah, you're not going to get that deep freeze necessarily, but you could experience probably just about anything there from a weather perspective.
Absolutely. Like I said, 3 inches of rain tomorrow, and then it's going up to 17 degrees Celsius and bright sunshine next week. So it's, you know, comes and goes. You know, it was below freezing this morning and, you know, into the low 20s this afternoon. So,
yeah. Mark, you mentioned that you're managing the family property. You got about 450 acres of bird. What does that bird habitat look like? You know, we talked a little bit about sort of the overgrown farms and orchards, but what else does real good grouse cover look like there?
So that's going to vary. And for us, we're going to have a mix of really good river bottoms that are, you know, heavily aldered. And the land that I manage pretty heavily, it's been in my family now for a little over 150 years. So we do have some of the, you know, some really good covers that are going to hold hawthorn and crab apple and a couple of those pieces. So kind of that classic cover. And then once you get up on some of the ridges, we've got about 250 or 300 acres of predominantly young aspen. And so again, fairly similar to what you're going to get in northern hardwoods as you get some of that regeneration, Nick. Our forest type here in Atlantic Canada is actually a very unique forest type called the Acadian forest. And so we're going to get a slight different mixture in some of those species, but predominantly, again, we're going to have, you know, I'm trying to get to kind of heavy aspen forest, which is what we have coming up. I do have some in mixed aspen and quite a bit in plantation as well. And so what I find is some of that thermal cover really works well. We've got on the 1,000 acres, we also have about 250 acres of spruce plantation through the property that is going to be anywhere from, I would say, about 15 to 25 years of age right now. And what I find, those bordering on some of those aspen plantations gives them really good roosting habitat. And the thermal cover between that and the red pine that we have tends to hold some nice birds. It's always fun to watch the dog trying to figure out where the birds are in the trees as he's trying to point in the air, which he hasn't quite mastered yet. But that's generally what it is. This year, you know, this year, to Andrew's point, the East Coast has gotten very, very high drought. And so we're finding almost all of our birds in close proximity to wherever's still carrying water. So our most predominant covers right now that I'm finding are all around the river and around kind of the alder bottoms. We have in New Brunswick, it's been really interesting. The western part of the province that holds a major river system that actually comes through Maine as well. And it's part of what separates the border from New Brunswick and Maine is the St. John River system. We've had very strong woodcock numbers on the western part of the province this year. Very, very good woodcock numbers on the eastern part and still holding really good numbers. The central part of our province, which is also pretty dry, they've had really tough times finding woodcock this year. So it's been kind of interesting that way as well.
Andrew, earlier when you mentioned you were 250,000 acres out your door, I mean, I know enough about Canada to know that there's lots of crown land and it's a, you know, it's a massive landscape, really, really is. And I'm looking at Onyx. Now, I know I was going to ask you guys this. Onyx for a long time didn't have Canada stuff, but they more recently do. Do you guys use Onyx now? And what kind of stuff can you find on there?
I use it religiously, Nick. And the only major difference that we have to watch out for is the frequency by which we're getting updates. So you really got to learn, you know, those cuts that look like they're not quite ready are generally the maps are generally 10 or 15 years sometimes behind. So you got to watch out that piece. And then the other major point for a lot of Canada is we can't get landowner information off of Onyx, but what we can do is get the PIDs. And then you'll have to use another government service to then go get the landowner piece.
What did you say? PIDs?
Yeah, so it's kind of the property. So it's the property ID number that we would then go look up in a government location or a government database that you would have to pay to get access to. That we could go then figure out who the landowner is. So we're always trying.
The purpose there would be you would potentially be looking to go ask for permission somewhere.
100%. And I use that, you know, we in New Brunswick, and again, all provinces are going to have a little bit of differences legislatively. 2 years ago, New Brunswick changed the trespass law where you needed written permission on any land that was used for agriculture. And really what they were trying to do, I believe, was minimize some of the damage agriculturally that was happening for people chasing deer, because in any open field in certain parts of the province, you'd start to get trucks going through and running it out. So they changed the legislation that said you needed written permission. So we've really, our group, especially for pheasant hunting, where we're hunting a lot more agricultural land than the grouse covers, We've been leveraging OnX pretty heavily there to figure out who's, you know, where are all the numbers? What are all the different covers that we want to go chase? Then we'll go figure out the landowner and try to go seek permission. To Andrew's point earlier, New Brunswick has very similar laws that if you don't have your private land posted, then anyone can access it. And you can post it in New Brunswick yellow that says you require landowner permission, or you can post it red. So every 100 meters, you would post it. If it's posted red, not even the landowner technically is supposed to be able to hunt it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so what we have here from the agricultural side is really where we've benefited a lot from OnX as well. And just, you know, like our brethren to the US, sharing pins, working together as a team to try to figure out what covers, you know, what we're really leveraging that quite a bit.
I'm just getting on the train. I'm just getting on the, I've been a Googler, you know, scouting that way. We have a publicly available Crown Land database. And so I used to use that quite extensively. I was, I was always, you know, checking the Crown Land, seeing where Crown Land was, because there are little hidden gems all over the place. I mean, 98% of what I'm hunting would be Crown, would be public land. And like I said, still never see anybody in any of them. But there are little hidden gems everywhere. So I'm more interested in the mapping side of it to find the covers. And so I want to know, you know, what am I looking at? Am I looking at wet areas? Am I looking at, you know, overlaying topography with it? Where, you know, what did the cover look like? And I like being able to go through the seasons, because you can see when the leaves are off, where the, you know, where the hardwood cover is very easily. And I was using that, but I'm just getting onto the OnX train and need to start using it more, because I do understand how valuable a resource it is. But, you know, I definitely am going to start playing with that a little bit more. I need to pick up a subscription. So
yeah, I was curious. I was going to ask, you know, sort of what you guys were using before, and that, you know, I used to use a mix of Google Earth and Google Maps, and boy, it seems like a long time ago now. You know, the technology world changes so fast, but it's like, once you kind of get into OnX and you're in that platform, you know, it's all those things. But to your point, Andrew, I mean, that's half the fun for me now, is just kind of like sitting on the couch next to my dog, kind of looking and sort of dreaming about, oh, wow, that spot right there. And then going out there and putting boots on the ground and kind of seeing, like, you know, is it what I thought it was, or was it not? Obviously you're hunting too. So, but it's just, I just love that stuff. I love looking for those little corners and pockets. It's kind of like a little treasure hunt.
So I'm a little naive to OnX, but will it do discharge setbacks? Will it show, for example, in Nova Scotia, if you're using a shotgun with shot, so multiple projectiles, you can get it, you know, it'll offset 200 meters. I know one of the other apps out there does do that. So it will pinpoint where dwellings are, where homes are, and it'll give you a little radius around that of the 200 meter, and you can set it for shotgun setback or rifle setback. Does OnX have a feature similar?
Mark, you would know better than I. I've never heard of anything like that.
No.
But man,
not,
if
not
my buddy
Canada.
Ben from OnX is listening, that would be yeah. We have stuff like that. But as far as like a layer that you could turn on or off with the radius, yeah, that'd be pretty neat.
One of the competitor apps does have that as a feature. So it was, I did dabble in that because it was pretty interesting to see, you know, you get two overlaps and then you've got this like 400 meter corridor, 400 yard corridor between the two that is, you know, perfectly legal to hunt.
I wonder how, if there would be a, what kind of data set you know, obviously you could go and look through at the satellite imagery to pull that together, but you know, the one thing that OnX does is, you know, they give you a lot of tools to kind of adapt it to the way you want. So you could set up areas. I don't know if you could do a radius. That would be an interesting one. If you could, you know, hey, I'm going to hunt this cover. I know there's a house here. Let me pop down. You can create your own areas and draw shapes and stuff. So you maybe have that, but that's a neat idea. I guess, Mark, what, you know, from a habitat perspective, you know, it's just this amazing, you know, chunk of forest that, you know, management has got to be, there's got to be so many variables. And as you said, like, it's going to vary from region to region, but what are the challenges, opportunities that are facing forest management, you know, as it relates to rough grouse and woodcock in your area?
Well, when it comes to forest management, in New Brunswick, we're going to be about 50% crown land and about 50% private. And the province would be broken out into what we would call major licenses, forest operating licenses. And we've got a pretty old system for how we manage that. So I think there's about 10 licenses. I could be wrong in that. 6 to 10 licenses, major licenses here. And each one of the licensee holders are a major forest industry player. And they are responsible of working with their departments of natural resources to come up with long-term, generally 80, 85 year operating plans. They'll break that down to about 35 years. And then they get really tactical in the five, Nick. And on the East Coast, you know, when we look across Canada, we've got very different challenges when it comes to forest management or when it comes to access based on where you're at. And so in New Brunswick, we have a lot of clear cutting that happens as you know, to try to mimic natural disturbances and forest fires. And that's why we use clear cuts. They're the closest we can get to mimicking nature. So we really have an endless supply of forests that are in that would be mixed age forests and the different successional timelines. We have a lot of planting that happens here in the province, New Brunswick. And in New Brunswick, we are still spraying herbicide and doing herbicide applications on large tracts of land, both public and private. So if I'm putting my woodcock and grouse lover hat on, sometimes it's hard to see those beautiful early successional hardwood blocks of land get sprayed to help support the plantations. On the other side of it, I can put my forester hat on and say the more volume we can produce in a very industrial forest, the less acreage we need to turn into that plantation style forestry. So personally, I'm always kind of fighting two evils, which is the grouse and woodcock hunter versus the forester, and trying to find the middle ground there. Quebec's going to be the same thing. Fairly similar, different forest type. But very similar in its management styles. Then as you go into Ontario, you've got kind of Southern and Northern Ontario with really two distinct different challenges that they're running into. And Southern Ontario, where we have, you know, our greatest population base in Canada, really. If you think about Toronto, the GTA and Ottawa and that whole kind of Southern corridor, I know Andrew can talk to this really well. The challenge there is a lot less forest activity, harvesting activity, and a lot greater challenges for access to hunt for those that are residing within kind of that Montreal to Ottawa to Toronto corridor of a pretty dense people population. When you get into Northern Ontario, again, you get really heavy forest management activities and practices. And so we're really not... The good majority of the country isn't lacking necessarily for habitat. It's, you know, we've got a plethora of great opportunities to go hunt. I don't know, Andrew, if there's anything else you want to add there as you think about, you know, the other directors that are across the country.
Yep. Certainly Southern Ontario, heavily agriculture as well. The St. Lawrence lowlands are heavily farmed, right? We have pretty extensive farming all the way through southwestern Ontario. We do have a chapter, RGS Canada chapter in Tillsonburg, and they're doing some great work on some public land there to try to make sure, you know, it's going to support grouse and support, you know, good forest management. Nova Scotia, not unlike New Brunswick, but, you know, we're very shallow soiled out here. We have shallow soil, fairly acidic soil, you know, legacy acid rain, that sort of thing from industrial boom and just prevailing winds. It was depositing a lot of acid rain here in Nova Scotia. So we managed almost exclusively for softwood. And so, as Mark said, with the herbicide spraying, we're not nearly as much public land as we are private. We're somewhere 70% private. Some of these forestry companies own huge tracts of land, 50 to 100,000 acre tracts. All great hunting. You can hunt it unless they're foresting it actively.
Yeah.
So, you know, you go back Google Earth, you look at the images, you go in, find somewhere that was cut 10 years ago and there you go. But it becomes a problem when they go in and they start thinning and basically they're trying to get rid of all the competition, all that hardwood that's competition, that aspen. They're really trying to reduce that so that they can focus on the profitable softwood, whether it's lumber, whether it's biomass. You know, there's a lot of emphasis on softwood. And, you know, if I put my fisheries hat on, you know, that poses some challenge. It sort of intensifies that acidification because, you know, as softwoods decompose, they tend to be a little bit more acidic, where you have more alkaline in your hardwood. So as the leaves drop, they're actually a little bit more alkaline. They make a little bit what we call sweeter water for the fish as well. And so it's funny, you know, some of our most productive grouse areas are also the most productive areas for our native species, brook trout being king, and of course, Atlantic salmon. And those two are often hand in hand. We talk about October cast and blast all the time. You know, you spend, you know, the first two passes swinging for salmon, then you change gears, grab your upland gear, and you're walking through stands of hardwood that, you know, that have been relatively untouched. So it's a different experience for sure. But, you know, similar.
When you say softwood, is spruce
and
that kind of
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, spruce and pine. Yeah. So we're very focused here on particularly white spruce, black spruce, and red spruce. You know, we're the Christmas tree capital of Canada. We export more Christmas trees than anywhere else in the world.
Wow.
You know, you wouldn't believe how many Christmas trees go down to Florida from Nova Scotia.
Oh, really? So I suppose, yeah.
They just, you know, it's by the truckload. You know, it's intensive management. You know, they work on a 30 to 40 year cycle of just, you know, plant thin harvest. And, you know, it can pose its challenges, but, you know, that's part of our job here is, as RGS, is to try to encourage and push managers towards, you know, diverse forests and uneven age forests, and trying to get things done in a way that's suitable for grouse and for all habitat, or all species that require that uneven age habitat and young forests and things like that.
Yeah. Let's kind of pull on that thread a little bit more. We've Rough Grouse Society Canada, because it's, again, we're gathering here, like, you know, there's this incredible opportunity, all of this public land, the forest is there. It's not like you're lacking in forest. It's just the management of. So do you see Rough Grouse Society Canada as it's a facilitator of encouraging different habitat forest management techniques and trying to find where that happy overlap is amongst the timber industry that we need to create that disturbance, mimic that disturbance, but then obviously looking for sustainable wildlife populations and that sort of thing.
I think we're at the stage now where that's where we want to go. We're small. I mean, you've probably got 10 times the number of members in your state alone that we have in Canada. You know, we're looking at 300 members, 400 members. You know, we've got some new initiatives for any of our Canadian listeners. Membership is free right now. We're not charging any fee. We feel strength in numbers is more valuable than the modest amount that we get from a membership at this time. So we'd like to see like-minded folks come together. We want to encourage that collaboration. We'd like to see chapters start popping up across the province. I mean, Nova Scotia had a chapter, you know, about two or three decades ago. It kind of went defunct. I'm not really sure the history of why. But, you know, when I reached out about 4 or 5 years ago and said I wanted to start a chapter, I mean, I started a Facebook page, and within a few weeks, I had 1,500 members part of the page, and, you know, people very interested, but nobody was signing up. I had seven paid members in Nova Scotia because we weren't doing any work here. But it's sort of carriage and horse, right? We got to have the base. We need to have the community. We need to have strength in numbers, because if I approach our politicians and say, we want to put this aside, he'll say, how many members do you have? And I say seven, he's going to laugh at me. But if I can get, you know, a few thousand members in Nova Scotia, then it looks like, you know, likely some of them are their constituents. It's likely that, you know, we have a lot more power in numbers than just saying, you know, we have $1,500 in the bank account that we generated from membership. You know, we can leverage far more than that. You know, in every province, there would be a habitat stamp that you have to purchase with your license that goes into a provincial fund. Those funds can then be used for conservation, or are intended to be used for conservation by organizations like RGS. So I'm hoping that, each province will start to grow their membership and then approach their governments and say, listen, we have this many members. We'd like to apply for $20,000 or $30,000 to, do some habitat work. And, in Nova Scotia, and I'm sure it's the same in New Brunswick, we have these little 100-acre parcels scattered all over the province, and there's no reason that they can't just say, we'll do a dollar lease to a Rough Grouse Society. You manage it for the next 25 years and see what you can do with it. And that type of thing, it already occurs with other organizations. So Rough Grouse can follow suit. It's same applying for corporate money. Bass Pro Shops has a great fund. I mean, they funded our Nova Scotia Salmon Association. We used to have a Pheasants Forever chapter. They funded that. So, approaching corporate donors like that will be an option going forward if we can build the membership base. And then what we can do is use that money to contract foresters, to leverage in-kind funding, and hopefully, do some quality forest management that benefits, rough grouse and a number of other species.
Yeah, I can definitely appreciate it. I just think that's a point worth underlining, that strength in numbers. Again, it's common sentiment for folks to, you want to, hey, I'm getting involved. Why am I getting involved? What is being done on the ground? That process is completely logical and it makes sense. But when you're talking about groups that are that small, it does make sense just to throw your hat in the ring and be a part of that group, show that there are numbers there. There is an interest and an advocacy there, and that strength in numbers. I think sometimes it does get overlooked, and I wish that wasn't the case all the time.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm even thinking back to, when I first started into the conservation organization world with Ducks Unlimited and a few other local organizations, I was doing my graduate studies and said, listen, I have no money to give you right now. I'm a full-time student. I'm making pennies. But what I do have is enthusiasm, time, and I was willing to put in the sweat where I lacked it in funds. I could, I was happy to grab a chainsaw, happy to do whatever was necessary. I used to we were banding waterfowl for years. I used to band a few thousand ducks and geese every year just because, I don't have the money to hand out to contribute in the same way. But what I lack in funds, I made up for in effort and dedication to the cause.
Mark, I'm curious, if a chapter were to get involved in a habitat project, what might that project be? Is it maintaining trails and access? Is it advocating for a specific cut in a specific place? What are some of those things that it could be?
I think the majority of the work that the chapters are doing right now is going to be about access for us. And because today we would have limited influence on the forest management plans that are happening in the actual harvesting.
Right. That machine, those wheels are turning.
And ultimately we have an incredible opportunity to start to work more and more with different forest industry, because they manage, at least in New Brunswick, and this is the case in the majority of the country, they manage large tracts of crown land for the government themselves. They do most of that heavy lifting. And so I think we do have a great opportunity. And Nick, if I could just build off a couple of things that Andrew's saying, because, both him and I joined the board at a similar time. And I really see the next couple of years as a little bit of the rebirth for RGS Canada. And, you'd said something earlier, about where are our funds going? And one of the greatest challenges I think that we've had in growing RGS Canada was exactly that. What is the work that's happening on the ground? What's the value that we're getting for our financial support of the organization? And the reality for us in Canada was about 98% of the money that was coming in for memberships was going directly to our, you know, to RGS in the US to get the Covers magazine. And what people were essentially buying was covers. They weren't actually funding conservation work in Canada. And so one of the changes that we've made in Canada is we want you to come. Like Andrew said, we have one option as a free membership to go build our numbers in our friends membership. And then we have different tiers of paid membership. And we've been really intentionally working hard to demonstrate what Tillsonburg doing, what Fredericton and New Brunswick are doing as chapters, what's going on in Nova Scotia from work on the ground that will then help to kind of support and grow the organization. You know, we have pretty ambitious growth targets over the next number of years when it comes to that membership. For the project work itself, Andrew hit on it a little bit earlier. We've got Tillsonburg that's worked on some real access projects right now and partnering with the local DU chapter as well. We've had some good habitat work, some clearing work, some bunch of trail work done in New Brunswick. And in fact, they're going through another project here shortly on that as well. So the majority of our work is in access right now.
I want to segue a little bit and just kind of talk about grouse hunting in general, grouse and woodcock hunting. You know, there's, as a kid growing up in northern Minnesota, you know, my dad and my brother, and we used to take fishing trips to Ontario, go to Canada. And that was like, you know, again, it's like, oh, we're going to Canada. Like, we're going to catch more walleyes than we can imagine catching, you know, on the lake near town. And that was very often the case. What does it look like from a bird numbers perspective, just grouse in general? Are there, you know, you've got this vast resource and you hear stories, but healthy populations of birds, are there trends? Are there cycles? What are we looking at?
So we're seeing, I'll jump in, then Andrew, I'll get you to jump in from your perspective here on this. So this year's a bit of an anomaly because of the drought that we've seen. So one of the things is we've got a number of covers where we would be expecting to see grouse where we're not. And then we have other covers that almost have doubled the number of birds in them. I think we've got some pretty good grouse numbers this year. And again, our woodcock numbers are phenomenal. If you can switch out, have a few dogs, you know, running through the day and you're in good covers. This year, consistently between myself and some of the other guides across the province, it's very easy to get 50 to 75 woodcock flushes in a day. And you can easily see between 15 to 30 grouse flushes in a day. There's been lots of times we put out 16, 17 grouse in an hour and a couple good covers. But yeah. Very, very common in the right now. I was talking to an outfitter in New Brunswick. We were actually hunting pheasant yesterday together. And earlier this week, like 2 days before we hunted, they put up, I think, 55 woodcock. And I think it was 18 grouse that day. So 50 to 75 to 80 flush days are they're a very consistent thing here.
Not unheard of. Yeah, that's a good day. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got really strong numbers. Our pheasant numbers in New Brunswick, I think this year, are probably about half. I think they had a pretty bad hatch. What we're seeing half the flush counts that we would normally get. But yeah, and woodcock are still really strong. They haven't started their southward migration. Right now, we've experienced really warm temperatures, not a lot of frost yet, and a lot of freezing. So we're seeing woodcock in covers that likely wouldn't be here, given that we're the 30th of October, and still good numbers. Even the northern part of the province, I moved, I think it was 11 or 12 woodcock in about 45 minutes in a new cover. I'd never hunted, and that's in a fairly northern part of our province. So we are still seeing pretty good numbers this year.
I would say ours, you know, similar story. If you can find water, that's where we're going to be. And, you know, historically, we were hunting grouse a little bit higher. We weren't quite as deep in, you know, into areas that were pretty wet historically. And they would always hold woodcock. But, you know, some of the go-to spots that I've had the last few years, and I would say, you know, we're at a high cycle for grouse right now in Nova Scotia. You know, last year was probably the most exceptional year I'd ever seen for rough grouse. I think there were two or three factors. I mentioned the hurricane. So we had Hurricane Fiona hit in September 2023. It left forests, you know, swales of aspens just tipped over, looking like a game of kids' pickup sticks. But what that did is provide incredible cover for them. And most of those stayed rooted. So they were still producing fruit, still budding. And so those birds didn't have to, you know, expose themselves. They could stay covered and still feed. And then you had a strong snow cover that winter, which again led to high survival. You know, I do spring drummer counts here on my own property. And from my back deck, I had 17 different drummers this year. And, you know, birds just sounding off everywhere. I had four pairs of nested woodcock, right, you know, visible from the deck. And, you know, you'd see them doing their evening dances. And you know, we all sit out. Kids love it. We all sit out on the deck and just watch them, you know, in the twilight. But I would say numbers are probably still there. It's just you got to find them. You're going to the wetter covers, areas that in past you've gone, yeah, I don't really want to go in there with, you know, with the hiking boots. And I'd normally have to wear rubbers to get in there. You know, this year those are dry. But that's where the birds are, getting a little deeper. The areas that are more heavily shaded, so thicker cover is keeping a little bit more moisture in the ground. You got to work for the birds, but you know, I think I spent the first 2 days just frustrated as could be, not pushing near the number of birds. And then I went to one of the other covers that's produced for me in past, and it made up for the first 2 days. I mean, within the first 5 minutes, we'd bump 15 birds and they were just breaking left, right, and center. Fat, you know, you're shooting a double and you're sitting here going, man, I dropped the two, but you know, we got birds flushing as you're reloading at the click of the gun. You've got, you know, it's just like, what's going on here? And, you know, those make up for it, but we've had a bunch of rain in the last 2 weeks and I'm starting to see birds making their way out of the lowlands back, you know, up into those uplands slowly. And they're showing up in the apples. They're showing up where they should be at this time of year. And then once the apples start to turn and rot, we start to see them a little bit further into the aspens, into their more traditional covers that we see. So that for me has typically been sort of middle, late November. I start to really start, you know, focus in on the hardwoods rather than the old abandoned farmsteads that we've been hunting in the early season. It's been a challenging year, but it all contributes to growth as a hunter. It all, you know, keeping notes, keeping, you know, I like to journal, I like to write. And so, you know, I'm keeping track of where the birds are, and, you know, it's been a learning experience, and that's half the fun of it to me is doing that. But it's also forcing me to explore new covers that I've never explored before. I've looked at on maps and said, oh, you know, I don't know about that. You know, I've got one cover that, you know, I've been sitting on for 2 years because it involves crossing a section of river, and the whole backside of it is crown public land, but it's an old abandoned farmstead, but you got to go waist deep in water to get to the other side. You can, you know, it's only 100 yards to get into the cover, but when you park, you got to cross it. And so, you know, looking forward to trying those. Yeah. Water levels are low enough now that, you know, you should be able to put on a pair of waders or hip boots, cross the river, just dump them right there on the other side, grab your hiking boots and go. So yeah, you know, that's a soon to be plan.
Those covers that have that little bit of a barrier to entry, those are the ones that really get built up in your mind as you're sitting there dreaming about it. You know,
you can see through the old Google Earth images. Like you can see the red apples on the trees. I mean, you're talking 100 acres of old abandoned apple orchards, and it's going to be a lot of fun once you get in there if it's holding fruit and holding birds.
That's awesome. Yeah, definitely some, I'm hearing some parallels. You know, we're very similar weather conditions, so warm. And like, I wanted to ask you, like, our woodcock season, you know, in the States, every state can have 45 days. It's federally managed birds. So 45-day woodcock season. We're coming up on the end of woodcock season here in Minnesota. I don't know the exact date, but we're pretty close to it. It's usually early November. And it's going to be one of those years where this is not unheard of, especially in the last, you know, in recent years, but the woodcock are, there's just nothing to push them out yet. We have not had the frost. What's the woodcock season in Canada?
Well, that's generally going to, the regulations are generally going to vary often by province. We're fairly lucky in New Brunswick. Our woodcock season is September 15th and November 30th. And generally we see the flights go through by the end of October, generally they're headed south. And so generally our you know, you're going to get a couple stragglers the first or maybe second week in November that are holding on. I couldn't tell you the last time I shot a woodcock past for us in Canada Remembrance Day or Vet EM on November 11th. Man, this year, I don't know what's going to happen because, you know, we're having a hard time getting anything below freezing. And, you know, it's going to be 58 or 60 degrees here today. And, you know, I'm going to go hunting t-shirt later. It's just unheard of. You know, I think, you know, our numbers and our limits, we've got an 8 woodcock a day limit.
Wanted to ask that too. Yeah.
So in New Brunswick, big limits and lots of days. It's been pretty good. One of the barriers, I think, sometimes to coming here to hunt, and Andrew probably say the same thing, is depending on the province, many provinces, you require a guide even to hunt in the uplands. So in New Brunswick, you require a guide. So there's very little DIY hunting that happens from non-residents. And I think that's probably been one of the barriers, because, you know, here the idea of woodcock hunting is we're a pretty small group of people that chase woodcock in the woods. In fact, if you talk to most people, they think a woodcock's harder to hit than a grouse. And I just stare at them going, what are you talking about? But yeah, no, our numbers and the limits each day are pretty generous.
Yeah. What's the limit on grouse?
6.
We're 5 in Nova Scotia. We're 5 grouse, 8 woodcock. And our woodcock season would be October 1st to November 30th. Grouse season, October 1 to December 31st. So we've got a lengthy season. I mean, I've finished off my season with snowshoes, chasing grouse. It's been a blast. The last few years, there's been a dusting of snow on the ground. We kind of have a family tradition of heading out into that big crown parcel on closing day of grouse season. We do up, usually save a few birds and do up a grouse soup or some other, you know, bush lunch. And, you know, we find a clearing in the woods and do it as a family, my wife, 3 kids, and we just sit there with the dogs and enjoy ourselves. It's more about the walk than it is anything else, spending time as a family. So we open and close each season together and have for a few years. So
that's really cool. Yeah. I mean, the traditions that surround hunting in general, no stranger to whether you're in the US or Canada, apparently, you know, that's what makes it special. And that's part of it. It's fun to have those rituals.
Absolutely.
Andrew, the English setter.
Yeah.
You sound, obviously you're very into the dogs and competent trainer. Yeah. Anything got you sort of uneasy or real scratching your head with the pointy dogs?
Oh man, I've been training labs for about 20 years. Like I say, we compete, we're all over, you know, Eastern North America. We run trials everywhere with the labs. The setter, totally new game. I mean, the biggest thing that I find, you know, we train our labs. Sure, we draw on their prey drive to try to teach them. But what we're doing in those trials is getting them to do things that are unnatural. So wind pushes the dog, you know, they fade with the wind. They fall down a hill, like they fade. And we're trying to get them to run straight lines. That's the purpose of the trial. Get them to run straight A to B and bring the bird back. Shorelines, you know, you don't want them to run a shoreline. You want them to swim a straight line. What I'm finding with pointing breeds is all we're doing is just developing the natural talent. So I want you to do everything that you do, but I want you to do it even better. I want you to hold that point longer. I want you to freeze up and stay still. So that's been the biggest thing for me, is I'm going, well, I don't really have a lot to do. I'm teacher. I teach her to quarter. I'm pretty invested in the Smith method of training.
Okay.
So Delmar Smith and what he's been doing for decades of successful upland bird training. And, you know, I'm very invested in that. The live bird access is a challenge for me, because raising, you know, doing everything with pen raised birds. And I do have, you know, minor moral dilemmas about chasing birds in the spring and just getting them, disturbing them. You know, I realized that it happens. And it's probably not the worst part of their day, but, you know, they're under attack 24/7, but, you know, especially when the birds are nesting and have young ones, I kind of stay out of the woodlot with the dogs. And, you know, here I am about to start, about to embark down the homing pigeon. You know, I'm sitting there with, You know, I've got coop plans. I've got leads on some homers that we're going to start. I'm going to start keeping bobwhite quail. So I, you know, we have a little bit of a hobby farm here. So I'm already almost set up for it. I need to build the individual pens, but space isn't an issue. That'll be one of the big things for me. I'm also a little bit of a tech nerd when it comes to this stuff. And the idea of the GPS and everything, I'm torn with the GPS. I love the GPS, but I love and romanticize the New England style grouse hunting with the bell. And, yep. I'm a double gun lover. Your Upland Gun Company hat. I mean, I've been following that since its inception. And, absolutely love double guns, love the history, the old wax canvas and, you know, getting away from the Gore-Tex and going back to George Bird Evans and going back to the olden days. But then I'm like, well, but I love the tech. I want to follow, but I want to watch the dog work too. So the idea of setting them loose and then saying, oh, on point 300 yards away through that thick cover, I want to see the dog lock up. So I'm kind of torn with how I want to hunt and how far I keep the dog. How much value do I place in the birds in the bag at the end of the day versus just being out for the watching the dogs, like, you know, watching this setter flow through the woods. My labs, I mean, they're a bull in a china shop. I watched him go through deadhead 6 inches thick and he's just running right through them. Where she finds these little, like, she's a relatively small dog, she'd be about 40 pounds now, and she just flows through the woods. And I've just never seen a dog run the woods like that, where it's like water over rocks. She's just in, out, diving, the speed, and then just the immediate freeze. It's, it's just such a cool thing. So I still split my time. We're, you know, now that we're hunting a little bit more, I'm down probably training 2 hours a day now between all the dogs we've got. You know, we were up, you know, 3-4 hours a day every day through the season, whether it's, you know, there's a lot of time spent set up and takedown with labs as well. We're having to run bird launchers. We have no one around us. So much like the hunting side of things, there's not a lot of dog trainers out here either. And sure. So finding like-minded people that are as diehard, you know, as we are, it's hard to find. And so it's my daughter and I, which has been an absolute blessing to spend that much time with her, connect with her on dogs. Like, I mean, we did, 12 weekend trials this year. And it's just her and I setting out. And we ran 24 events total. There's two each weekend. So we traveled all over the place and got to spend a ton of time together. And, it, you know, such valuable time to spend with them. So, you know, that's been fun. I don't think I'm going to go and trial this setter, but I've said things like that before.
We've all been there. You're not going to buy another gun either.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That. Yeah. Yeah. At least not one that I'm going to admit to the rest of the family that we've got.
There you go.
But no, it's been that part's so exciting. And watching them has been, it's rejuvenated my interest in dogs training for something different. And my 9-year-old's already set on an English Cocker. And he, his goal is to have an English Cocker next year. Legal hunting age here is 12 years old. We've just had it lowered. Oh, wow. So they have to hunt under the immediate supervision of an adult. But his goal is to have a hunt-ready dog for his first year when he's 12. He wants a little English Cocker. Yeah, wants to name it Rip. Wants a little male English Cocker named Rip, and that's what he wants. You know, he's been saving his money for 2 years for a dog. So they're
planning ahead. That's pretty awesome.
That's right. Yep. He was gifted a little 870 wing master and a 20 gauge short stock. So he doesn't have to buy his gun, but he's now set on buying a dog of his own. So
you're right in the thick of it. That's good stuff.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well, with 17 drummers out your back door, I mean, you guys definitely have the wild birds component checked when you can get on them and get the dogs into that. So that's a big benefit to you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun. I mean, we go out even in the spring when we can isolate the drummers, we'll set up the deer pop up tent and just sit there, take pictures, watch them drum on the logs. And I mean, it's so cool. And the kids hear it. So it's not like one of those things that you don't know is in your woods. When it's mating season, you know, they're drumming and they hear the forest come alive. You know, Mark mentioned how abnormally warm it was. Like this weekend, there were drummers out all weekend. I couldn't believe it. Like, I mean, what the heck are they doing drumming at this time of year? And just, you know, you could focus on drumming birds.
Yeah, that's cool.
Man, obviously you guys are a wealth of knowledge just individually. And I imagine, you know, there's other folks involved and hopefully we get some calls and get you guys some more like-minded individuals. That's for sure. You touched on it a little bit. I did want to make sure that I asked, just knowing that my audience is predominantly US-based. We certainly have Canadian listeners, but what do you know about if somebody from the US wants to come hunting there? Obviously there's the guide thing that you mentioned, Mark, but any other hoops to jump through, things that you're aware of on how a person from the US would line up a hunt in Canada?
No, I mean, it's ironically enough, it's much easier to get a shotgun, I believe, into Canada than it is as Canadian to get into the US. And so super easy to come across the border with a shotgun. I mean, just like anything, like, you know, I traveled to Kansas last year to hunt. Give yourself lots of time if you're flying and that. But easy to come, find a good outfitter. And really, there's a small number of outfitters, at least in the Atlantic provinces, that really focus in predominantly in upland species. And find a good guide, and that's about it. And they'll help arrange lodging, everything. And, you know, from an economic standpoint, I don't love saying this, but a weak Canadian dollar also makes the affordability to come to Canada to hunt one of those great things. I know the outfitter that I was hunting with, Wes, he runs March and Mill Outfitter here in the province of New Brunswick, and 90% of his clients are coming in from the Northeast. He had a number of people in from Connecticut, from Maine, I believe from New York this year. And I mean, you know, again, we border Maine, so it's a really easy for anyone in the Northeast to come for a drive. And besides that, no, it's just find a good outfitter. There's a few of them, and the same thing would be in Nova Scotia. I know both Andrew and I are licensed guides as well.
Yeah.
Although we do it more so that when friends and family want to come and spend some time with us, we can host them legally. Sure. I know that was motivation for me to become a professional guide, and I know it's the same for Andrew. But aside from that, very easy. And then the only thing is, if you're looking, if you're running any kind of specialty or less common gauges, bring some ammo as well. And that's what, you know, we've got, you know, I'm a big advocate. I run a 28 most of the time, just cause we're walking all day. I like a light side by side in a 28, and I'm buying ammo by the case whenever I can get it, because it's not readily available. So that would be the only other piece, is you can work with your outfitter to get that or plan to bring that if you're running a 16 or you're running a 28. Or something that's not a regular 20 or 12. That would be the only other piece of advice I'd give you. And quite frankly, I would hold off if you're coming. September 15th is a great time to get out, but you don't want to run your dog, I mean, at least the last number of years, more than like an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening, because it's too hot. And we'll start to see the flight birds coming in by the first and second week of October. And so I would say really target that second, third, and fourth week of October, a little bit into November, if you want to do that combination grouse and woodcock hunt, because once those flight birds are in, I mean, we're blowing cubbies of five or six woodcock up at a time. And then you get, you know, it's nothing to be in a good cover. You're talking every 3 to 6 minutes, you got a dog locked up. So, yeah. And so bring lots of ammunition too. At least if you shoot like me, bring lots.
Sure.
Yeah. One of our biggest challenges has been historically that we couldn't hunt Sundays. So, I mean, as somebody that, you know, I've been guiding for about 20 years now, and moving here, this is the first province I've lived in where I couldn't hunt on Sundays. That changed this year, thankfully. And that had been a major deterrent. I had about half a dozen calls last year from folks who wanted upland trips. But when we couldn't offer a full weekend and only had the Saturday, they all stopped in New Brunswick and gave Mark their business. And instead of continuing the trek across the isthmus. So that's been one challenge. You know, we've got that sorted out. But, you know, Nova Scotia has very, very few guides. There's nobody here that does grouse exclusively. I know of one other guide. So, I mean, I've taught the guides course here for the last 10 years. And, you know, there's very, very few people that hunt them. So that translates into very few people that guide for them. I know of one other gentleman that, you know, does one or two trips. His sports that a hunt pheasants, you know, it's a two rooster limit here in Nova Scotia. So, you know, you get your two roosters early, he wants to be able to offer them something else. And that's what they've been doing to fill the afternoon doldrum, if you will, is get out and do that. But hard to do that, make a living doing that. So there aren't many, and we don't have much in the way of lodging. We don't have outfitters out here. There's very little, you know, established sort of lodges. There's a few salmon lodges that still exist, but, you know, there's been a fairly significant decline in salmon access over the years. There's been closures due to dwindling numbers on two of our coasts, the Bay of Fundy, and then, you know, the Atlantic coast. The Northumberland Strait, which is the northern part of Nova Scotia, is still strong. And there'd be the odd lodge that still exists. But for that reason, you know, we don't see the same number of sports coming over here that, you know, historically came to salmon fish and to hunt. You know, there's a little bit more in the deer hunting side of things. We have some excellent deer hunting. But from the game bird side, you know, a season-long license for a non-resident is $75. So it's not particularly expensive, and that's $75 Canadian. So it's, like I said, not particularly expensive. Guide rates would be fairly standard across the board.
Andrew.
Yes.
I think you brought up an important point that I want to build on here a little bit. So yeah, we've definitely underserviced in the guide game. We've also had a real marketing problem in Atlantic Canada. Like, people just don't know about this little corner unless you go search some of the, you know, if you read like a Fall of Woodcock, and all of a sudden someone's going to mention New Brunswick or Nova Scotia.
Yeah.
You know, no one really talks about Atlantic Canada like they talk about Wisconsin. Like, yeah, they talk, yeah, about the UP. And, yeah, and I mean, we would have significantly fewer people chasing them with dogs and at least the equivalent numbers. But no one really knows about Atlantic Canada when it comes to hunting upland. And I think, you know, Andrew made a really important point about, we have few guides and, you know, not a lot of pull. I was over at the British Game Fair earlier this year, and it's a 6-hour direct flight from London into Halifax. And there's 125,000 people at the British Game Fair. Not a single person. And they love woodcock in France. They love hunting woodcock in the UK. And no one had even thought about or heard about the, or even contemplating the idea of a flight to Nova Scotia or New Brunswick, when from London up to go hunt birds in Scotland, it's a 6.5-hour drive. Like, and so I think we really struggle with a real marketing challenge to say, look at the richness that we have in opportunity, and the world doesn't really know about it.
And it's one of those things you don't want to say too loud, because you don't want to see every one of your covers fill up. But at the same time, you know, I've never met a bird hunter running a dog that I didn't have a great conversation with.
It can be a double-edged sword. But again, I mean, just what I've heard, and like, I'm looking at the map here. I mean, just the resource, not that we don't have amazing resources here in the U.S., but from a bird numbers perspective, and, you know, what sounds like, you know, a hunter pressure thing. Yeah, it sounds like a phenomenal, if you guys were closer, I'd be calling you up trying to book a room here for next month.
Make the call.
Yeah. I'm certainly glad I've connected with you, and yeah, hopefully you will get some calls from both Canadian residents and U.S. folks alike, just support what you guys are doing and to connect with you as well. So really appreciate it. Andrew, if you're going hunting tomorrow, what's your go-to bird gun?
I'm shooting Silver Pigeon 3 right now, 20 gauge. New job, wedding anniversary, built a new house. Said this gun is going to stay with this woodlot for life, so that my kids will always have a gun to come back to. Whether I'm here or not, when they come back to this land, they'll have something to be able to take out, even if I'm gone. I don't do Safe Princess. This gun's, you know, pretty beat up looking, but yeah, that's what I'm shooting now.
Good. Well, guys, is there anything else that you want to work in or mention? RGS Canada, just anything we missed or you guys were hoping to cover or mention?
Yeah, I just think we're just trying to grow, trying to, you know, have a look at our new website. We're just, we're trying to build up, we're trying to ramp up our social media. I feel like it's a dilemma, you know. I'm trying to do everything I can to put the screens down, but this is the way the world is going now. So,
yeah.
You know, I go in spurts. I'm trying to help manage that account and with Mark. So, you know, we're trying to get content posted regularly, but We'd rather be out hunting than sitting on our phones right now. So I'll call it content gathering rather than content sharing, but it'll come. Check us out on social and, you know, consider Atlantic Canada as a destination. It's, you know, it won't disappoint between the birds and the hospitality. You know, lobster's always in season somewhere. There's no shortage of places to visit and things to see. And yeah,
I think only Andrew, if I'll build on a couple things here when it comes to RGS, I mean, you know, when we really started to reshape the board a little over a year ago, we've been around since the 80s, but, and I think everyone would agree, a little bit stagnant when it came to how we demonstrated value. And in fact, everyone that I talked to that was a member of RGS Canada, the first thing they said is, what are you guys doing? And so 300 members, we're growing it now. In a year, we want to be at 600. In 2 years, we want to be at 1,200. We've got ambitious targets over the next 3 years as a team to go double every year. And I think there's a lot of value in our membership challenging, what are you doing? And we're working really hard as a fully volunteer board right now. Everyone is doing this from a volunteer perspective, to really start to demonstrate that as we grow. And so what I hope is, go check out the website. It's rgs.ca. Reach out, send an email, and, you know, at the very least, jump on as a free member. And hopefully over the next year, as we continue to drive a little bit more focus in the organization, as we attempt to grow, we can demonstrate more and more value to our membership. You know, we've got pretty ambitious goals. You know, in 10 years, we want to have chapters in every province. Ideally, we'd have two of the three territories covered in Canada as well up north. And, you know, I want to be somewhere at that 20 to 30 chapter range. We want to, you know, about 10x the amount of funding and revenue we have come in, so we can translate that into a lot of project work across the country. Because if you're hunting on Vancouver Island, some of the chapters and, you know, the challenges that you're going to face there, obviously very different than Southern Ontario and very different than Prince Edward Island or Newfoundland on the eastern coast. And so with such a large expanse and really grouse everywhere, we really want to grow this thing. And so, Nick, all I would ask is that if you're interested, reach out on Instagram, reach out on Facebook, pop an email in the contact us form on the website, and, you know, get involved. We had a lady reach out to us last week from Manitoba, and she's, you know, do we have any local chapters? What are you doing with Grouse Work? I couldn't get over the detail that she wanted to. It was phenomenal. I said, we don't have chapters. The next email was, well, can I join a chapter from a different province? Right. And so there are some people out there, some real enthusiasm. Yeah. And, you know, our goal is to really take 2025 as starting to lay the foundation, 2026 to really start to build some momentum, and try to get a little bit of the same velocity maybe that RGS in the US has.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. Well, good on you guys for doing it. Keep up the great work. Right there with you, Andrew. You know, it's I'd much rather be content gathering than content creating, but we got to make time for both. And that is one of the benefits of the technologies. We can find those like-minded individuals a whole heck of a lot easier than we could, you know, a few decades ago. But yeah, right now it's mostly cloudy, 43 degrees Fahrenheit, and the wind meter is reading zero. So I know where I'm heading this afternoon.
I guess so.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you guys. I really appreciate it. We will drop links in the show notes to everything and how to get in touch with you. This has been phenomenal. Shout out to Ken for connecting the three of us. Really enjoyed it, guys. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, everyone. It's your host, Nick, here. One more thing before you go. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Be sure to subscribe and follow the show so you don't miss our next episode. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can do so by joining our Patreon community. Click the link in the show notes to this episode. You can sign up for as little as $5 a month. And if you do, I will send you some of these Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you for doing so. Thanks, everyone. Catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.